Good afternoon. We have two cases on the 130 docket. This is Division 3 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. Are the parties here in the case of people in the interest of H.W. III?
Yes, Judge.
Are the attorneys here and prepared to proceed in, is the next one up, XL versus Westminster City Center?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I believe you received a set of written instructions when you came into the courtroom detailing our oral argument procedures. Do you have any questions about those?
No,
Judge. No.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
If not, we'll proceed to hear the argument in the first case. Come on up and have a seat. Get set up. I remind counsel to identify themselves by name and attorney registration number when they come to the podium. And I'd ask that everyone in the courtroom shut off any pager or cell phone they might have so as not to disrupt or interrupt the oral arguments. With that, you may begin, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Arthur Perlman, registration number 15194. I have the honor of representing the juvenile appellate H.W. in this matter. I'm going to take the issues in the same order that I presented them in my brief. First of all would be the fatal variance between the petition and the evidence presented at trial. In the petition basically alleged that H.W. had rendered assistance to the shooter in this case, having known that he was charged with a crime. And in fact, at the time of the alleged assistance in this matter, the shooter had not been charged with the crime. The petition omitted the language from the statute concerning having committed an alleged crime. We contend that this variance is a fatal variance. It is not a technical error by any means.
What would the remedy be if you were right?
I would argue, Judge, that the remedy would be dismissal of the case and releasing the young man from his sentence to DYC because he was not or could not have been found guilty of the charge as specified in the petition.
Well, let's talk about this. Are you familiar with the concept of constructive amendments?
I am, Judge.
Is it your position that the variance here affected a constructive amendment of the charging document?
I do not, Judge. And that's where I was going with that it was not a technical error. If, for example, the petition said the crime occurred on July 10th, and in fact the evidence showed that it was July 11th, and he was ultimately found guilty, then there would be a constructive amendment.
Wouldn't that have been a simple variance as opposed to a constructive amendment? A simple variance, not changing the elements of the crime? Just the evidence is a little different, but the elements, as alleged, are still being proven?
In my example, Judge?
Yeah, in your example.
In my example, that's correct.
Simple variance.
That's a simple variance and a simple amendment where the evidence could, or where the petition would be allowed to be amended to conform to proof. In this instance, what we have is a variance that goes to the very heart of the charge against the juvenile.
Does it go to the heart of the charge against the juvenile, counsel, or does it go to perhaps a sentence enhancement factor?
I think it goes to both. It goes to the very heart of it in that the facts of this case, and I'm not conceding the sufficiency of the evidence by any means, but the facts of this case, if believed, were that H.W. Assisted the shooter by driving him away from the scene. If the court accepts that as being assistance, that's assistance alleging that H.W. knew that a crime had been committed, not that the shooter had been charged with the crime.
You have to prove that a crime had been committed in order to prove that a person is guilty of accessory of a crime?
I would say that yes. I think the...
Where in the statute does it say that?
Well, he essentially in the accessory assistance statute. He has to know that a crime has been committed if the petition had been alleged properly.
But doesn't that language come out of the sentence enhancement portion of the statute, not the elements of the crime itself?
I believe it's the elements of the crime, Judge.
Didn't the information or the petition in this case actually allege in the language of the statute, the elements of the crime, and then allege in addition this other factor about, instead of knowingly committed the crime, knowing that he was charged with a crime?
Well, the petition actually tracked the language of the statute except for the language knowing that a crime had been committed.
And isn't that, though, language appear in the sentence enhancement factors or sentence enhancement provisions of the statute? What I'm getting at is this, counsel, if there is a problem with it, is there a problem with the whole basic crime, or is it a problem with the level of penalty that can be assessed with respect to this individual?
I think it's both, because one of the elements of accessory at the time is that HW had to have known that a crime was committed, and he had to have had the intent to assist the perpetrator.
Weren't those alleged? Weren't those factors alleged at the very beginning of the petition?
I don't believe they were, Judge. I will defer to the court's memory of the petition, but my memory is no. I'm sorry, Judge.
I guess with all due respect, I'm still not convinced that one of the elements of the crime itself is that you have to know that a crime was committed. I don't see that in the section of the statute itself. I see it as one of the possibilities for proving it's a Class 4 felony.
Your Honor, may I stray to the table to grab my file?
Sure.
Thank you.
Counsel, can you answer me this also?
Yes.
While you're looking, you can continue to look. Was the alleged co-defendant, was he a juvenile at the time of the alleged offense, or was he an adult?
My recollection is that he was an adult, Judge. And to get back to Judge Loeb, thank you for allowing me to stray, Your Honor. A person is an accessory to crime if with intent to hinder, delay, or prevent the discovery, detection, apprehension, prosecution, conviction, or punishment of another for the commission of a crime, he renders assistance to such person. Being an accessory to a crime is a Class 4 felony if the offender knows that the person being assisted has committed or has been convicted of or is charged by pending information.
Right. That's in Section 3.
That's true, Judge.
I've got another question along the same line. What if the petition, the charging document in this case, hadn't used any of the language from subsection 3? It just tracked the elements under subsection 1 and then identified as it did what the crime was here, attempted first-degree murder, and then said pursuant to subsection 1 and subsection 3, period, and left it at that. It was that language that we're all worried about now, was that necessary language? Or could the prosecution just have cited the statute to put your client on notice that the sentence enhancer was going to be subsection 3?
I think they could have just cited the statute. I believe that would have given sufficient notice, Your Honor.
So if the language wasn't necessary, why should it be reversible error that the proof deviated from the language in the petition?
Well, Judge, because we are a notice state, and although I know that Mr. Hernandez prepared his case along the lines of the bill of particulars that have been provided in terms of rendering assistance at the time versus knowing that a person had been convicted of a crime. It's still providing proper notice to the juvenile, and in looking at, for example, the Bustamante case and the other cases I cited, we're talking about errors that are jurisdictional in nature. And that's why we also argue that there is no waiver because of the fact that it's not a technical error, it's a jurisdictional error, and therefore, not only is not waivable, but is fatal.
Counsel, if it's a jurisdictional error, under our, if it's a jurisdictional error, it failed to allege a crime, any crime, isn't the answer to that is, okay, jurisdictional answer. There was never the jurisdiction of the court invoked, so go ahead and retry him again.
No, Judge. I think if it's a jurisdictional error, in essence, it calls for dismissal of the case, dismissal of the charge, not a retrial, because it is jurisdictional. Any other questions, judges, before I go on to the next point? Thank you. In terms of the bill of particulars, there was a motions hearing, and both sides cited the language between Mr. Hernandez and the district attorney in this case. And basically, Mr. Hernandez had filed a bill of particulars and had had discussions with the district attorney, and he indicated to the court that since he was being advised that they were solely relying upon leaving the scene, driving the perpetrator away, that he was withdrawing his request for a bill of particulars. I think the two sides are now interpreting the language, the discussion from the district attorney's perspective differently. Our perspective is that there was essentially a stipulation that that's what evidence would be relied upon, and the DA's response that they had provided information and discovery was merely confirming that they had provided the information pertaining to HW supposedly driving away. When the court then allowed the district attorney to go beyond the bill of particulars, for example, by allowing Detective Sanchez to testify that HW never rendered assistance to authorities, which legally he's not required to do, and failure to do so is not in and of itself deemed an accessory, that was improper.
Does the bill of particulars have to set forth all the people's evidence?
No, it does not, Judge. Not at all. But the bill of particulars under People versus District Court does limit the people to the evidence that they can present. So if they say, we are relying on this, that's what they're bound to.
Was there any showing that the other evidence the people relied upon was not provided in discovery?
Not that I'm aware of, Judge, no. I think there was certainly notice of that. Your Honor, I'm going to, since I'm running out of time, I'm going to jump to sentencing. Two issues for sentencing in this case. First of all, that just hours before the sentencing hearing, Mr. Hernandez received the PSI and did not have time to investigate it, so he asked the district court, the juvenile court, for a continuance of sentencing to investigate that, and the judge denied that, reset over till the afternoon, and allowed Mr. Hernandez to cross-examine the author of the PSI. As I indicated in the brief, this situation is a mirror image of the Wright case, and the defense has the right to investigate the PSI report, not just to cross-examine the author, but since so much was not provided in that report that is deemed appropriate and required by Title 19, Mr. Hernandez had the right to investigate other resources and be able to present those to the court. By not granting the continuance, Mr. Hernandez was not able to do that. So we believe it was an abuse of discretion to deny the request for continuance. As for sentencing itself, essentially the juvenile court jumped from zero to DYC with nothing in between. HW was eligible for probation He had not been in out-of-home placement before. He had not been on juvenile intensive supervised probation before. He had not had any juvenile program services to rehabilitate him.
Weren't the allegations, or wasn't the proof serious in this, about a serious offense in this case, counsel?
It was a serious offense, Judge, but it was not a crime of violence. It did not carry a mandatory sentence in this matter. Certainly, the judge should consider the seriousness of the offense, but the court should also have considered other alternatives, more rehabilitative rather than punitive in this matter. And so that is why we argue that it was an abuse of discretion to jump straight to the most serious sentence that a juvenile can receive. I see that I'm about to run out of time. I'd be more than happy to answer any other questions the court might have.
Counsel, thank you. You have about 10 seconds if you want it for rebuttal.
That's fine, Judge.
Hold in full 10 seconds.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Your Honors. My name is Rhonda White, attorney registration number 35996, and I represent the people in this matter. The juvenile was charged with accessory to attempted first-degree murder. He was adjudicated as a delinquent child and sentenced to out-of-home placement in the Division of Youth Corrections. I would like to first address the juvenile's issue that there was a fatal variance between the petition and the evidence. A delinquency petition is similar to an information, therefore it must provide sufficient notice of the charged offense. This is to allow the juvenile to be able to adequately prepare for trial, to protect from subsequent prosecution for the same offense, and to avoid surprise. Here, the juvenile's petition tracked the statutory language of Section 188-1051, and the petition indicated the application of enhancement factors pursuant to Section 188-1053.
Actually, it just did one enhancement factor, didn't it?
Yep. However, the petition set forth only one of the three possible alternative enhancement factors. The three enhancement factors that make the accessory crime a Class 4 felony are if the offender knows that the person being assisted either one has committed, or two has been convicted of, or three is charged by pending information, indictment, or complaint with a crime that is either a Class 1 or Class 2 felony. These are all included in Section 188-1053. Here, the juvenile's petition included only the third alternate, that being that the offender knows that the person being assisted is charged by pending information, indictment, or complaint.
And they didn't prove that one, did they?
No, they did not. But I believe that there is no issue with the petition in this case, because the juvenile was put on notice of the charges because the statutory section was incorporated by specific reference in the petition.
Wait a second. It says the statutory section is incorporated, but it doesn't incorporate everything. It selects a part of that statute. How can we expand what was alleged in the petition?
Well, I think that the main issue is here is whether he was put on notice, and the specific section was incorporated. I mean, it was stated in his information.
So let me go back to this question. Could you have just charged him an accessory to a crime simply by saying you're charged with accessory to a crime, Class 4 felony, sections 18-1, 105, 1, and 3. No text. Could you do that?
I think that it probably isn't in our best interest, but I think you definitely...
You think you could do that?
I think, no, you probably need to include the section 1 stating what the elements of the accessory crime.
Well, let's go to the next question then. Under Apprendi, don't you have to also allege the sentence enhancement factors?
Well, I think that here it's sufficient to state what the section is, especially because...
Unlike elements, you can't just cite the section. You have to actually put the elements. But with sentence enhancers, we can treat them differently than elements under Apprendi?
I would state that we would. I think that in some degree we would. I don't think that it's as much of a necessity. I think he was on notice of the sentence enhancement factors, and so therefore having the specific essential elements of the crime set forth and then stating what the possible enhancement factors are sufficient in this case.
But how was he on notice of what your theory was other than what you set forth in the petition? The petition alleges specifically the third alternative.
Right.
Now, if I read that, why wouldn't I assume, well, that's what they're gonna prove at trial? Nothing more, nothing less.
And I think that what, I mean, basically, we're talking about an issue of form versus substance, and I would argue that it isn't an issue of substance. It isn't a substantive defect.
What is a substantive defect, counsel?
Excuse me?
Help us understand the difference. What's a substantive defect?
Well, I think that that would be something, as opposing counsel stated, that would take away the jurisdiction of the court. And so to respond to your previous question, it would be that the court had no jurisdiction at that time. Here, I don't think we have that.
What would qualify as a substantive defect?
The lack of a name, the lack of a date, the lack of any statutory section, anything that would not put someone on notice of what specifically was happening. And here you had enough to put him on notice of the date, his name, the elements of the crime, and the statutory sections that would state to what the possible alternative enhancement factors are.
Let's assume, for purposes of argument, that we don't find that argument very persuasive.
Okay.
The question then is, what's the remedy? Would the remedy be to dismiss the whole case? Would the remedy be to just drop the enhancer and drop it down to the lowest level of crime, which is a Class 1 petty offense?
Well, and I wanted to get to the prejudice issue, which I think is going to address it, but if you did find that all of that, I certainly don't think the remedy is to dismiss the charges. I think that if anything, if it got to the point where you determined it was such a substantive defect that the court lacked complete jurisdiction, which I don't agree with, I think that what you could do is you would simply recharge the juvenile and put the proper alternative enhancement factor in that you're using and then go to trial on that theory.
But he's already been found guilty of being an accessory. The problem is with the sentence enhancer.
Right.
So what do you do with that?
So I think that I think that you're taking away the whole jurisdiction. If the court didn't have jurisdiction for any of it, then we could start over again. There was no jurisdiction for the court to find the defendant or the juvenile guilty.
There's no jurisdiction for the court to find the juvenile guilty of the basic offense?
I think if we're taking away the entire jurisdiction, which I again state that we're not, the court had jurisdiction.
Let's assume the problem is with the sentence enhancement factor only. Would the court have had jurisdiction to adjudicate him guilty of the underlying offense?
Yeah, I mean, I think the accessory crime, but I'm saying that enhancement factors, you would be able to go under an alternative theory because he's still found guilty of the accessory crime.
He's found guilty of the accessory crime.
Yes.
But there's a problem with the enhancement.
Yes.
What's the remedy then?
I think we would go back to sentencing and look at what class of felony we're going at under the alternative enhancement factors. But I still think that we would be able to state the first alternative enhancement factor that he knew his co-defendant committed the crime.
What felony class would you go back and try to sentence him on?
I mean, I would still say a class 4 felony because you have the evidence that he has committed the crime.
So in other words, you have a violation here, but he gets stuck with the same class of felony enhancement.
Well, and I think, I don't think you would go down to the class 4, 5 felony. I think that you would stay with the class 4 felony because you have, and I'm saying that the court has jurisdiction. I don't think that he wasn't on notice, and I think that there's also, he doesn't show any prejudice in this case.
Our hypothetical may assume that the court had jurisdiction over part.
Right.
And the court had jurisdiction actually over the second, but it wasn't proven.
Right.
And then the question is, okay, would it be double jeopardy to subject him to another trial based on a class 4 felony allegation that would be different than the one upon which they originally proceeded?
Well, I don't think so, because if you're taking the jurisdiction out of the sentencing enhancement factors, then he isn't protected from a subsequent prosecution for that. The court never had jurisdiction to impose the class 4 felony.
Did the court have jurisdiction to impose any sentence?
I believe so. I mean, I believe that they had jurisdiction to impose the class 4 felony as well.
Let's assume that they didn't have jurisdiction to impose the class 4 felony for one reason or another. Did they have jurisdiction to impose any sentence?
I believe they did. I mean, I believe that they have, yes.
And wouldn't the remedy be to remand it for adjudication upon the lowest level of offense for accessory to crime?
I don't believe that that would be the remedy. I would like to say that the remedy would be to remand it and then continue with the evidence based on the class 4 felony under a different alternative enhancement theory. However, then the further remedy, as you're suggesting, would then to be go after the class 4-5 felony, which I don't think would be appropriate in this case. But I think I also want to talk about the fact that he suffered no prejudice. I think that the record indicates that he was fully aware of the charge and the alternative enhancement factors.
Do we worry about prejudice if it's a constructive amendment?
Well,
if the variance is of a nature, not of a simple variance, but a constructive amendment, do we worry about prejudice?
I think we do. I think, I'm arguing that, first of all, this is one of four.
No, I know what you're arguing.
Okay.
do we worry about prejudice?
Yes.
If we're concerned with a constructive amendment?
I think we are. I think that if we look at, I mean, the entire purpose of looking at this is whether or not the juvenile was on notice of the charges, and was he able to adequately prepare a defense? Was he able to avoid surprise or not be misled at trial? And I think that he was. Defense counsel even stated that the statute requires that the juvenile knows that the crime was committed, so defense counsel clearly knew what theory the prosecution was going under. Further, the petition was specific enough to allow him to prepare an adequate defense, as the record shows that the juvenile presented evidence to try and show that he did not know that his co-defendant committed the crime. Therefore, I believe that the juvenile was aware of the statutory language, the charge, and the potential punishments against him, and therefore there was no fatal variance in the juvenile's petition. I would like to briefly address the second issue, that being...
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
After the prosecution rested its case, I think the defendant argued a motion to acquit. And in that argument, he talked about, or she, I'm not sure which, talked about knowledge of committing a crime as well as the issue of being charged with a crime.
Mm-hmm.
Does that constitute a waiver of the... of the variance?
I think when you're talking about what the prosecution was stating as, or the defense attorney.
Yes.
I believe that there was waiver in this case. I think that any variance goes to the form, and therefore it must be raised prior to trial, or else it's waived. But I think that they
it couldn't
knew...
couldn't be raised prior to trial, could it? Because they wouldn't know what evidence you're going to put on until the trial occurs.
Right, but I believe at this point they're not bringing in the judgment of acquittal. I believe the main theory that the defense counsel, if I remember correctly, stated was that the juvenile did not need to suspect but had to know that his co-defendant committed the crime. So therefore, I think that they didn't have an issue at that point with the petition in this case, and they were aware of all of the charges and the punishments against him. So I believe at that point. They did waive it. I think that they they didn't object to it at that time. With regards to the bill of particulars, the juvenile contends that the juvenile court mistakenly relied on evidence that exceeded the scope of a bill of particulars. However, in this case, there is no bill of particulars to review because it was withdrawn prior to trial. Additionally, there is no indication that the prosecution agreed to a stipulated bill of particulars. Instead, the prosecution stated that anything they were relying on was provided to the juvenile during discovery. Therefore, the prosecution properly referred to all of the evidence at trial. Finally, I would just like to briefly address the juvenile's issue that the juvenile court erred when it denied his request for continuance in the sentencing hearing. A trial court's ruling on a motion for continuance will not be reversed on appeal absent a gross abuse of discretion. And there's no indication that the defendant or the juvenile did not have time to adequately review the record. He received the report the day before the hearing, and he also knew that out-of-home placement was an option. And that's distinguishable from the case that opposing counsel cites, which is Wright, which in that case, counsel received the report about an hour and a half before the hearing, and he was surprised that the enhanced sentence was a possibility. So therefore, the juvenile court did not err when it denied the juvenile's request for a continuance. Unless there are further questions, the people would respectfully request that this court affirm the juvenile's adjudication. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have about 10 seconds, counsel.
Maybe I'll just make one sentence.
Okay.
Thank you, Judge. If the court should find that the variance should not lead to dismissal, but to the lowest class. May I continue, Judge?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. To the lowest class of accessory, which the court referred to as a petty offense, I would remind the court that in that situation, if that were to occur, that under our statutory sentencing system, a juvenile cannot be sentenced to DYC on a petty offense. So that certainly is prejudicial, and it certainly affects his sentencing and current whereabouts.
Okay, counsel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.
Case will stand submitted. Opinion will issue in due course. I thank counsel for their arguments. Thank you.